Good. So welcome, everyone. So tonight we are still working with the complete teachings of Mahayana. For those that are new, you can get the passcode to get this text online. So you can ask one of us or one of the coordinators for it. The material is all there. That makes it a little more accessible that way. So this is class six, and this is actually talk three in this book, The Complete Teachings of Mahayana, by Trungpa Rinpoche. And tonight the topic is the spiritual friend. But we thought before we begin this, there was some material that wasn't covered last week in the chapter on Buddha nature. And Michael covered that. He presented that material. So I asked him to actually fill in that little piece that we haven't really worked with yet.
So there was a little... there was something in the questions, and it went like this. How do you distinguish between impulsiveness and spontaneity? Mm. And that was the question. I'm going to read a little bit of the whole question. Rinpoche, you said that impulsive afterthought is ego, while the immediate thought is Buddha nature. How do you distinguish between the impulsiveness and the spontaneity? To begin with, Rinpoche replies, you could say impulse is not spontaneous. It may seem spontaneous, but it doesn't have the relaxed quality of spontaneity. The impulse comes out like a sneeze as a result of some pressure. Whereas you could say the spontaneity is like yawning. It has less pressure. It takes its time. or another way of saying that, it doesn't take effort. The glimpse of Buddha nature is not violent. Whereas the impulse is very violent. It's desperate. Question, is the impulse Buddha nature? Rinpoche replies, no. The spontaneity is Buddha nature. Then the impulse is ego? Yeah. What you react to first then is the ego, and Rinpoche then turns that upside down. Not necessarily. Impulse never reaches the first stage. Impulse always trails behind. Impulse is never up to date. It is the rebound. First you see, then you react. Impulse never comes firsthand. It's a reaction. So that's very interesting. He's saying it doesn't come first. It comes afterwards. It's a cover-up. And it happens after the original Buddha nature. So I thought it might be helpful to look at where we've seen the same thing before in different terminology, and that's in the last thing we studied. You remember about first thought? People remember first thought? A little bit of a quote. Ask yourself that question, who am I? You may find that you do not have an answer. From that non-answer, that simple gap or open space, you may experience a flash of who you are. I refer to that glimpse as first thought. That first thought is not regarded as a particularly enlightened thought, but it is a true thought. It is your raw and ruggedness. It might reflect confusion or insight. Don't ask too many questions about it. Just let it be there as your first thought. We're usually more circumspect about the first thought we come across. So, we drum up a second, more reasoned thought. This second thought reviews the first and makes us feel safer, more legitimate. Sometimes we don't even trust that thought. So we go out of our way to ask someone, a parent, a teacher. After the first thought, you begin to change your mind, which is second thought. You begin to make it into something else rather than acknowledging what you have already seen. So does that seem like another way of saying the same thing? The impulse, not only is it not the first thought, not only does it come out with effort, but it comes out afterwards. This is always something he will present again and again, that our first experience is our Buddha nature. Then we don't like it, and we cover it up.
Is it we don't like it, or ego doesn't like it? Or,
well,
who's we?
Very good.
Can you give an example?
No, I'm just trying to... I still struggle with first thought, but I'm just trying to wrap my mind around. But that idea that... I mean, it's sort of, you have this idea... I carry around an idea of who I am.
Yeah.
That ego, you know, works with me on, I am this person, I am like this. And so if I suddenly see that there are other options, then what's ego going to do?
Cover it up.
Well, yeah. Because if I just was this other...
Yeah, I can't blurt that out. I'm going to have to come out with something more acceptable, right? Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to have to come up with something more unacceptable. Or somehow or other, we're going to cover it up, smooth over it, change it into something else. So we're going back to our story, basically. Chris, you want to say something?
Mm-mm. No.
Could you say that awareness is close to first thought? And also, is awareness Buddha nature?
Well, is that your opinion?
We've been over this. I have a thought about it. No. That's my thoughts on it, not my opinion.
Well, I don't know about that. If you want to present something, I doubt that it's your immediate experience. You're presenting something you want to explain away with. We go through this every week.
Aren't we always trying to be aware, though?
Yeah.
So isn't, I mean, I think what Harry said makes sense to me, that awareness would be part of our Buddha nature, at least.
Pretty soft. Pretty real.
I don't know. I mean...
Okay, that's fine. So how do we get away from our story? How do we say something? How do we get away from having to hear the same story again and again, whether we keep quiet about it or whether we keep telling other people about it?
Focus on your out-breath.
That's what I was thinking.
Or you risk the story.
Will that do it?
Being aware that it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So also that you know that you can push pause.
What good does that do?
Well, the tape isn't running.
I hope it
is. That story isn't running. That loop isn't going. You're pausing it.
How can you do that? Your mind doesn't have a pause button. This gadget does, but your mind doesn't.
Well, I think from the work that we're doing is the way you're doing the out breath, that is the pause button, because that gap is that pause button.
The gap.
Well, realize what the stimulus is that's compelling you to act or think. Is it coming from your own mind? Or is it coming from a sense of attachment? And I attachment would be impulse, because you have an attachment to do something or to say something.
So we can be mindful.
And spontaneity is awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And more clear.
Okay, so we can be... I think what we need to do is to stop telling the same story again and again and again. That would be helpful, wouldn't it? So, actually, Emily provided a brilliant exercise later to do that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. But we want to cover up, like, I'm confused, so I'm going to say, well, I'm really not confused. I have a very good experience of Buddha nature. So there. And not only that, but I understand it pretty well. People really ought to listen to me, right? Because I understand it. If they listen to me and do what I say, then they're really going to get enlightened.
Really?
Yeah, you agree with that, Shlomi? Okay, so our story doesn't always sell.
So do you have something to... because you were the one that posed the question. What are you thinking?
That's very helpful. I'm just thinking about the urgency of the impulse. Maybe the
violent nature of it. Mm. Yeah, it's really, he described it as a sneeze. We got to do something. We can't just let rest in what. First of all, we don't like Buddha nature, really, most of the time.
She asked the question. Does it stem from the same place?
Yeah.
The spontaneity and the impulse.
Yeah, ultimately. But the impulse is an editing.
Is an editing.
Is an editing,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So ego, that's the mixing of ego with the outcome. Whereas I think spontaneity is that direct connection. So there's not it's not mixed in with ego. It's something very clear and direct.
So why does ego have such a big impact?
Because it wants to be seen and heard. And it wants to keep the story going about how great I am.
But if clarity makes more sense and it's the first to appear, why does the second take over?
Well, because clarity comes out of the gap, and that space scares us. We don't want to be in that open, empty space. It's really quite frightening, and we move out of it as fast as we can.
But once we touch it, we want to touch it again and again. So why do we keep running away from it?
Well, I tried to give an example in which, first of all, the confusion was covered up by saying I understand it. Then the doubt about that was covered up by you ought to believe that I understand it, and so on. So there was a whole series of
cover-ups.
Yeah, but it can go. But I chose it that way because often I hear the opposite. I'm something terrible, and the story goes that way, and then there's a cover up of that, and soon it gets confusing, and everyone's telling me what to do, or everyone's telling me that I'm confused. So we can have we can start to uncover these. There's a first cover up, there's a second cover up. It keeps going. And if we can start to work it out, then I think that helps.
Yeah. I was just thinking of the example of Zen archery. And there was a teacher that I met, and I only tried this once or twice, which was Kudo. And there is all this preparation and exactly how you hold the bow and how you turn it and how you draw it. The whole thing is very programmed, but then there's a moment that's not programmed, which is the tension is a certain amount, and then there's this natural release. Like, it's almost like you don't release, it releases itself. The bow releases itself, and the arrow flies. And to me, that's an example of spontaneity. It's like there was a preparation, but the moment at which that goes, it's a spontaneous moment. And it's not mixed with ego, because it's really not about where the arrow goes. I mean, they're always undercutting that view. It's about that mind, is your mind opens at that point. So I think if we can think of examples, that might help. But I would like to wrap up this discussion so we can move on. Does anyone have a final comment on this? Or? Okay. So tonight, is that okay, Michael?
Yep.
Okay. So we're on talk three, and I did, thanks to Elise, she suggested putting an outline online. So I didn't get to it right away, but I think I did it on Tuesday or something. So one thing that's helpful in trying to understand these talks is if you actually look yourself for these three factors or this outline that's within the talk, there's always a ground, which is the base or the starting point. Then there's path. There's something that's going to bring you along from that starting point. And then there's a fruition, which would be a result of following the path or taking some action. So this talk is called The Spiritual Friend, but I think it leaves out a lot from this title, which is Maitri. So I'm going to be speaking about Maitri and Spiritual Friend. We'll be discussing it as we go along. So the ground, again, is the view of Buddha nature. And what I wanted to emphasize here and what's carried forward from the previous chapter on Buddha nature is that Buddha nature is a state of intelligence which questions our life and the meaning of life. So it's this questioning and curiosity and critical mind, you could say. So then I pulled out a question from that. Why are questioning and doubt so important in the Buddhist path? And I thought this was quite curious, so I'd like to discuss this. Trungpa Rinpoche says, "We are still searching for the questions. This questioning is Buddha nature, a state of potential." So why didn't he say we're looking for answers? Instead he says we're looking for questions.
It's an opening.
To
question is to open. To answer
is
to close.
Is, yeah, completion. Or I've got the answer, boom. You can stop right there. But when the questioning is the process, so it's a constant opening. Any other comments on that?
I think answers that we come up with are always from the mind, from separation, and is always conceptual. Whereas the question is not necessarily conceptual. It invites, it's open to non-conceptual whatever. But once it becomes an answer, it's a concept.
Right.
If we're living in this moment or living in concepts.
Yes, so that was really good what you just said. You're either living in this moment, the present, or you're living in concepts.
Or stories.
Or stories, yeah. Which separates us out from what's really happening in the moment. That's really helpful. Thank you. So this questioning, well, this is what I think is so interesting about Buddhism, that it's not a system of beliefs, although maybe you feel it is. I don't know. You can argue that. But it's really about each person examining for themselves whether or not what's being talked about or presented is true to them. And only through your own examination, can you actually understand something? It's not like information that gets poured in your head and then you regurgitate it in a test or something. Maybe I was thinking we should have a quiz. So watch out.
This is
good in nature. I just thought I'd play the answers to my questions. Yeah, really. Right. That's a great one. I just thought we needed more humor. But anyway, I guess we'll laugh anyway. We'll try to find some humor. All right. So basically what he's saying is the importance of questioning, examining our life, dissatisfaction, questioning, doubt, and irritation. This spark of intelligence is what activates Buddha nature. And actually, irritation is really a good point. When you start to get really irritated by working with Buddhist teachings or trying to understand them, that's actually ego feeling the rub of, I can't quite figure this out. If I could only pin it down, I could keep it in a box and I could control it. So I find that when the irritation gets the most, I'm closest to understanding something non-conceptual because it can't be pinned down. And maybe that's a lot of the frustration we actually experience in this class and studying the Dharma is, there are a lot of things we talk about that we say we can't really explain, and then we're trying to talk about them. So this curiosity and this it makes me think of an oyster. You know, a little bit of sand gets in the oyster, and what happens? You know, it's a pearl that emerges from that little irritating grain of sand. So you can take that irritation as a clue that you're getting closer to ego's jumping. Ego's jumping doesn't like it. So watch for that. So the ground, again, is Buddha nature. So this is what we talk about, is every single person has Buddha nature. Every person is a Buddha. Yes?
So I'm a little confused on the spark of intelligence opens Buddha nature. I thought he said it is Buddha nature.
Yes, it is, but also there are different levels of this word prajna we talk about, which is clear seeing, and it starts with dissatisfaction, and then we look at that. That's the first noble truth, and it's like a can opener, I guess. It's opening. It is a way to open to Buddha nature, and Buddha nature underlying everything is the primordial open space. But the irritation, the intelligence is, these are all the thoughts that we're trying to get rid of, right? You've heard that? We're getting rid of our thoughts? Hello? No.
What thoughts?
Yeah, but intelligence is Buddha nature.
I think he says it both ways, actually. It's the questioning is the Buddha nature, a state of potential. And the spark of intelligence activates the Buddha nature. I think of it more that way. And maybe he did say it is also Buddha nature. Because it is, this intelligence is the Buddha nature too. But it's also what opens it. So,
I think there's also a problem with the English word is, because is can be, A is exactly B, or it can mean that A has the qualities of B. Mm. And I think those two can get, I am sad, I'm a lot of things other than sad. It's just like I have, So I think that those, assuming that it means that A is, that it's exactly that thing is sort of problem with the overuse of the word. So maybe just that it partakes of many qualities, and so that they're not necessarily contradictory definitions.
Right. So Buddha nature contains intelligence,
yeah.
But it's beyond. It goes beyond what we think of as intelligence. The narrow definition of that. It's also fundamentally non-conceptual, and we often think of intelligence as concept, and that's where we start. So Would that make sense from the way you're explaining it? The subsets and all of those diagrams.
I can visualize. I'm trying not to be technical. Just that is doesn't has a lot of. It's used in so many contexts.
Yeah.
So don't assume that it's a complete definition.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And prajna would be part of the definition.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. But I think there's a tricky piece because I think like prajna, if you think that's wisdom. Wisdom, we don't think of as being thoughts, but intelligence, like when we normally talk about it, like with someone intelligent, oh, they have good thoughts that they express. And that's not really what we're saying here.
No, he uses intelligence differently. Right?
Yeah, more like wisdom.
Wisdom is prajna paramita. And we're going to, at some point, we will get to the paramitas, which are transcendent. So, prajna paramita is transcendent prajna. So it's going beyond concept. It's mind or intelligence going beyond concept. But that's not where we start, right? We start with our little questions. And, you know, who am I and why am I unhappy or wherever we are. So the path then is how to awaken Buddha nature. So the aspiration to look and question and understand comes from experiencing misery and pain or suffering of self and other. What we experience and then we see others as well. And he says that what do we need to awaken Buddha nature? Allegiance towards the spiritual friend and dedication. That would be dedication to the path of discovery. And we go into spiritual friend in a minute. So the point here seems to be that we have, quote, the point here seems to be that we have to begin with the development of Maitri. So Maitri, this is a Sanskrit word, and it means love or a kind, friendly attitude. So this is, they translate often as friendliness and starting with friendliness to oneself. And I have to say that I always just sort of, this was just part of a list of the four immeasurables. And when you first start studying, sometimes things just seem like lists that don't really mean very much. Oh, yeah. I'm sure you've never had that experience. But, in fact, when you really start to contemplate, that's why I gave you contemplation this week, you start to understand what's really being described here. So we're starting, this is a really key point, the starting point, and we're talking about Mahayana. This is the path where we're moving from Hinayana, working on ourselves, to Mahayana, which is expanding our heart of wisdom and our compassion to other people. This is the transition point where we start with Maitri, which is compassion or friendliness. They don't even use compassion right here. It's really friendliness to ourselves. Yes, Roberta.
Yeah, he does say that somewhere here that unless you've accomplished that, you're not ready to take the step of a spiritual friend. I believe you have to have. Yeah.
He does say that.
Yeah, he does. He says, this is, I just saw it. Unless the fortifications of home ground have been broken down, you can't relate to the guru, Kalyamanitra.
Kalyamanitra.
So, that the Hinayana Maitri.
Well, we start with Hinayana, but in fact, we can move along the path in many different ways. So you don't have to sort of take that literally that, you know, you can only go to the next step when you've accomplished something, like that you could never move on in the meditation technique until you've actually worked with your mind in a way that you can rest in shamatha for a half an hour or something. I mean, that isn't the approach we take. We actually open the path much. It's a much wider path than that. And we try to understand the fundamentals, But we also look beyond that because it helps to have a bigger vision of where we're going. And this chapter gives us a bigger vision because it ends with compassion, which is basically the path of the Bodhisattva. So we're here in this middle ground, you could say, where we're starting to look at how do we treat ourselves? And what goes on in this little mind, you know? What's our path of self-criticism and our little story that we tell ourselves all the time? When we meditate and sit down on the cushion, we start to see the stories repeated over and over, and you go, oh, there I go again with that. I'm not worthy, or I'm not, you know, whatever. But that little spark right there is a really good place to begin to apply friendliness. So I'm wondering if people had a chance to see my contemplations at the end, and if people started using that, and what you might have discovered from that.
yeah, that's something that I've seemed to have tried on my own, even though, I mean, it was something that I knew was the problem that I have to deal with. And that sense of leaning in that we were talking about, I don't know, many weeks ago in terms mm-hmm. of... And I've actually been experimenting with going back to something even further long ago that we were discussing, which is the texture mm-hmm. of that experience, you know. And it was very specific in terms of the heat and the stickiness and the, you know. And I also find... when I lean into that stuff, that it's very disquieting. Mm-hmm. And I want to physically move.
Bolt.
Yes.
Run.
Run. But I don't.
Mm. Do you use it more in your meditation practice or just like at other times?
Well, I think in my meditation, I try to be more mindful of that. But I also, in my daily life, I'd like to try to catch those moments uh-huh. because I just am tired of that accumulating inside. And in some ways, in my daily life, in my more lucid moments, which are few, it actually is a relief because I can actually I can actually step outside and not get caught up in the story and not like and stop the accumulation mm-hmm. And that I don't have to act on impulse mm-hmm. in a situation that it may be triggering, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should just read the beginning contemplations just in case people haven't heard of them. So what I presented online, and this is posted if you haven't seen it yet, the contemplations I'm asking people to do. Number one is reflect on your inner critic. Write out a list of the shortcomings you constantly enumerate in your head. Number two, can you apply Maitri to each of these supposed shortcomings? Three, one by one, can you embrace and accept each one? Four, can you write a new script? What would this sound like?
Well, just number two is a big deal here.
Yeah.
Well, since I tried...
We should pass over to Griffith.
No, I wanted it for the tape, yeah, so okay. People would hear what the questions were.
Is this in the email?
Yeah, it was in the email, and it's on here, too.
It's on the sheet that we handed out on the back, and it's online under class 6. Which is right. This class.
But I did the first one yesterday, and sort of, it was interesting because I was saying before class that what I found was I sort of started, you know, making this list and started to realize, like, oh, They're just all bad habit, not bad, but habits, right. Habitual patterns. Right. Each one was a different kind of thing, but it's all this habitual stuff. And I tried the second thing today, and I was just thinking, and it was sort of, what I was trying to do was, what would I do if somebody else said to me, mm-hmm. I'm really struggling with this? What came to mind is yesterday I had a friend who told me about, she has a child who's really struggling with mental health issues. And there's not much you can say to someone. Like, you can't say, oh, it's a cold, they'll feel better soon. Right. Or, I'm sure they'll get him, you know, I'm sure the antibiotics will, you know. Like, there wasn't anything to say except, I get how hard that is for you. I understand having, having a child who struggles and not being sure what to do. And realize, like, oh, could you say that kind of thing to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. I totally get how that's really hard for you, because I experienced it, but, like, and it's not, you can't just solve it because you don't like it. Like, this is uncomfortable, I wish it would go away, but I get that that's really hard. And that was that piece of saying, like, oh, I could do it for other people. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of pull it around and say, so what would, like, that whole thing people say, like, why do you want to have somebody talking at you all the time? You know, voice you would never use with any other person on earth. The meanest, nastiest person. Right, the meanest, nastiest person you met, you wouldn't talk to, like, what do you do? You're so stupid. You know, they, like, you wouldn't do that. So I think that piece of sort of thinking, like, how would I react if somebody else said to me this? Oh.
Yeah. Like the metta prayers.
Yeah. The what?
The metta prayers we did long ago.
Yeah.
So actually, yes. That reminds me.
Metta is the same word as Maitri.
Yeah.
Maitri. Yeah.
Yeah. That was just something I read this weekend in a book. You know, you're the only person in the room who expects you to be perfect all the time.
Good point.
I think also, like, I find myself saying to just my sister or people, like, if I only listen to my own advice. You know, like, I'll tell other people how they should, you know, deal with a problem or talk through issues with them. And then I think to myself, God, if I only did that to me, you know, or talk to myself like that, it would be, it's like a foreign language to myself.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, as Michael said to me today, that it's, you can't, you know, do this all in one day, you know. This is a path, and I think it's really wonderful to start to contemplate this on a regular basis. It doesn't have to be every day. I don't think we've really taught contemplation here, so I wanted to say a word about that in case you have any questions. And I answered Elisa's question at 4:50 this morning, and she didn't actually look. I was so proud of myself. contemplation, it's interesting because it's like everything we tell you, it'll be the opposite. So, you start
just for the headway.
This is good, Roberta. This is good. So you could start a contemplation with like 5 minutes. Let's say you're doing 20-minute practice period. So you could do 5 minutes of shamatha, just settling down, being present. Then you bring up the question, and it could be one of the ones I mentioned or something that comes up for you. Or if there's something in the reading that was confusing or you want to contemplate more, you bring that question up, and then you work with whatever comes up in terms of an answer. And the idea is, instead, we're not holding our mind to the breath, we're holding our mind to the question as well as what answers come up around it. And we do that for a period of time. Let's say you were going to do, as I said, 20 minutes, 5 minutes shamatha, 10 minutes on the contemplation, question and answer, and 5 minutes ending with shamatha again. So that would be like more formal contemplation sessions if you wanted to spend time doing that. Some people have more, you know, have a kind of more proclivity towards this than others. So it's really totally up to you. Or you can just reflect on these things while you're walking or something too. So is there any question around
Oh, Roberta, yes. You have another question. You love math. Roberta's
one.
I mean, I think of contemplation as just thinking about something, isn't it?
Well, it's actually deeper than that. It's more than just thinking. It's actually settling in and going, allowing it to go to another level. So let's say with Maitri, if you're contemplating your whatever comes up, your shortcomings, or you may come up with an idea or two, but you might actually sink deeper into that. Not like go into your whole history and where this came from, but how it feels in your body. Where, you know, what does that do for you? Or you may say, wow, this is a really big pattern, and you may see other pieces of it that come together. So it's a little different from just like randomly thinking about something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like maybe disemboweling yourself, torture yourself.
So do you really avoid going and thinking about where it came from? I mean, do you really, if you find yourself going down that path, is that just not a path you should entertain? You know, that, you know, like fear of criticism because, you know.
Well, generally, you know,
not saying both, but
I don't really know how to answer that, to be honest.
It's not.
The thing is, we try not to do analysis around the origin of it because it's more about like really seeing the pattern and then liberating it or surrounding it with kindness and that loving kindness over time can change how we work with our own situation, our own mind. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't know. I don't know.
Can
What's
I have
the thought?
A suggestion? I think it's more being in the moment of what it is right now than you're experiencing. Because if you go into analyzing how it formed, you're experiencing, you're living in the past. And how it came to fruition, and it gives you another reason to beat yourself up about it.
What
if you're trying to get to the germ of the of what it is right now, it's making you live in the moment of facing it and leaning into it, and you know, getting into the pain of it.
But the way Emily constructed this, so you've done step one, and now you've accumulated something like a bunch of mean criticisms that I have for myself. Then, step two, it says, would I treat anyone else like that? So now, can I accept myself and generate the kindness to treat myself more kindly the way I would treat someone else? So that's the next step there. So so by doing this day after day, you're accumulating material, then you're working on forgiveness. Mm-hmm. That's step two.
Good.
Mm-hmm. So we're moving forward into dismantling the compulsiveness of our story and forgiving us for having the story. And we see that other people have stories, and we can start to be more loving to ourselves.
What if you feel that you would treat other people that way?
I mean, well, you can look at that.
Yeah.
I don't think you do that.
Yeah. But so what happened for me, Roberta, was also like looking and saying, well, I see how this is really hard for you. And then thinking about, like, if I had a student who said, I have this, you know, I'm really struggling with, you know, this, like organization or something, I might say, I see it's really hard for you. Can we think of a way that acknowledges the difficulty and looks for little pieces instead of like saying, if only you would just straighten up and do things. Like, that doesn't, you know, I would never say to you, just straighten up and do what you're supposed to do. You'd say, well, let's see if we can take a baby step forward in a direction that you'd rather see. But that doesn't require that you say the way you are is terrible. It's just hard.
Yeah, I agree.
It's creating a soft spot. It's like, yes.
For starting with ourselves.
Soft spot.
That's a beautiful way
that's
to
the transition it. Being emphasized here.
Right. Right. And why does this matter? Why couldn't we just go launch into Mahayana? We're going to be kind to people in the world. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Because what is in there? The word should and good. I put those all in bold here. There was a clue, you know. Because it's not about should and it's not about good. This is a great, at the end, he said on the first page, this expanding of Maitri cuts the neurosis of wishful thinking. Thinking that you should just be a good person. Maitri is intelligent friendliness which allows acceptance of our being. So it's really coming to terms with our kind of our neurotic thought patterns and thinking, well, I wish I were this way or I should have done this or I should be that way. It's really having fundamental acceptance of all of us, all the parts of us that come together to whatever, you know, there we are. And that's really the beginning, the foundation of stepping onto the Mahayana path.
I'm having trouble buying it, I think, partly because I do feel like there's good and bad in it, and it's like the spontaneity and the other one.
Impulse,
yeah. It's like spontaneity, good, impulse, bad. I mean, it's, you know, grasping is good, grasping is bad, dwelling in the now.
The reason we don't emphasize good and bad is because that's duality. You're always splitting the world into dualism.
But I feel like the message is there.
Well, that's how you're hearing the message. So yes. I think it's really good for you to go back and listen to the talks online and see if the message is really the way you're hearing it. I can understand why you feel that way, but we hear that same story every week from you. So I think it would be good to go back and listen to the talks and see what's being said, because we're not saying, you know, we're not saying this or that. We're actually going to be going through the middle path in terms of non-dualism, where we have to see that things open to non-concept and a very open space. When we're always judging good and bad, that's not what it's about.
I feel like I read it, too. You know, I feel like...
Well, that's the way you're... Well,
Trungpa Rinpoche says, spontaneity... is the Buddha nature and the impulse is the ego.
But later on, it talks about that you need one, needs
you
the
need
other.
Yeah, but I think that's, we're kind of faking. I think there's a little fake in it. I really do.
You're assuming that one of them has to be, that if one is good, the other is bad, and that's really not what they're saying.
I feel there's a,
They just have to kind of coexist together.
I feel like I sniff something.
The ego is very important. How would you, if you don't have ego to work with, you don't discover Buddha nature. You know, if you don't have dark, you don't have light. So they coexist.
They're part of a whole.
They're part of a whole.
They're relative.
But like, you know, every week we talk about being free from the,
ocean
of samsara. You know, and samsara is grasping and aversion and ignorance. And all those things are what we try not to do. So.
But we do them anyway, so we have to learn how to live with that.
Right. It's being free from it, though. Being free from it isn't not doing it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it's good.
Say more, Chris.
I think that's all I have.
No.
You have more. There's some wisdom in there. I know. You can't. No.
May, by this merit, may all attain perfect awakening. That doesn't seem realistic.
It's an aspiration.
And realistic is your word.
Right.
It's your word and your definition of that word that is coming from somewhere. But it doesn't have to come from somewhere. But yet it does come from somewhere. And so the freedom is being free from that. Where does it come from? It comes from here. Oh my gosh, it does. And it's free, to me, it's freeing ourselves from that, from the struggle, mm-hmm. from the anxiety of that it's this and it's that, right? It's this and it's that. It's good, it's bad, it's white, it's black, it's yin, yang, up, down, right, left,
right?
It's all of those things. And I think our nature is to struggle with that all the time. Oh, I'm such a bad person. No, you're not. You're a good person. Oh, no, because, yesterday you yelled at Gary, so you were a bad person. But being free from that constant anxiety and worry and labeling, that's a freedom. And that's, I feel mm-hmm. like that's the path. That's the path that when I feel like I'm on the path, I'm in the middle. Like mm-hmm. Emily was saying, I'm in the middle of it. I'm not this or that, that or this. I'm in the middle, and it's all around me.
Yeah, it just feels like there's a, when we say that, and that makes sense to me. I guess, by this merit may all attain perfect awakening, seems like perfect.
I found a section, I don't want to go into the book now, but it's something that explained the nature of that aspiration to me. I'll send that to
okay.
I had the same sort of doubts, and it clarified what that means in a really concise way.
The whole thing rising above all of
it. Or just the bodhisattva vow and what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want
right.
just
good, thank you very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to go on to the word Kalyanamitra. And again, these words in Sanskrit, they are actually pretty easy to pronounce if you just divide them into syllables, which you may not know where they are in syllables, but so it's Kalyanamitra. Kalyanamitra. And it means spiritual friend or guru, in this case, the way he's describing it in this chapter. But basically, it's someone that works with you directly, someone outside of your home ground. So you could say, well, how does that relate to me, and who is that? So you could say that we provide, as teachers, meditation instruction and direct work with people individually to help them along their path and to talk about their meditation practice and ways that, you get stuck or have ideas about other things that can help you in terms of your own path. So you could say, in this context, you could say that the teachers are spiritual friends. It also has a larger context than that. And we also try to introduce people to other teachers that are way more enlightened than us that could actually help you along your path as well. So I think the way he's talking about it here is the fact that we can sort of get stuck, and if you have someone who's a mirror for you, who can reflect back your way of thinking or areas that you may not see where you're stuck and may give you more input, that can be a spiritual friend. So the idea here is it's a guide on the path. And that is actually more important as you go further along the path. So in Hinayana, it's this person would be more like, the word is elder, so it could be someone who represents an example of someone who's been along that path. In Mahayana, we're starting to work more on a much more kind of a deeper level of cutting ego. And there's actually a reaction, I think, when you start working on that level. And you might bolt, you might react in different ways. And having a relationship with someone to talk about your practice is really helpful. So we are available. If anyone wants to meet with any of us, you're more than welcome to do it. But basically the idea here is the spokesman of the world outside your home ground. And he says, oh, I love this. Of course, I changed the gender. I know, Linda's saying, this is 70s. Okay. Yeah. Just look at my write-up. She is seemingly friendly to you at the beginning because you are still suspicious of her friendliness. So that means that, you know, we enter into these relationships or even our own relationship in practice and studying the Dharma. There's suspicion and curiosity, but that's fine, you know. But you can be suspicious of someone's friendliness. But basically, you know, there's a quality of this person is a mirror. And there's a real unmasking process in studying Buddhism because we're cutting down our concepts and these boundaries that we have. So having someone to work with can be really helpful. As he says, a trustworthy person, a good person, a mirror. So, and then the fruition that's presented in this chapter is compassion. He says, relating with a spiritual friend brings us out of our home ground of seemingly domesticated Maitri, which is more working on your own level, to the level of compassion, Karuna, which has to do more with Karuna is working with others in a compassionate way. So we're really extending ourselves further. That seems to be the turning point of commitment to the teaching. So here we're talking about extending our own friendliness to ourselves further into the world and further into compassion with other people and connecting more directly with the teachings. Our intelligence of Buddha nature begins to function. So instead of things being more just ideas, you could say the Mahayana is where the rubber meets the road. And it's funny, you know, I think about the yanas, yana being vehicle, and in Hinayana, I think of the feet as the vehicle. You're walking along the path. You're an individual. You're walking along the path. In Mahayana, you're on the bus. And they're there with their chickens, and they're there with their loud music or whatever. You're on the bus, and you're going, you know, it's a bigger road, and you've got more people around, and you're going down the Mahayana highway. So we're making a transition to this space of, to this wider view and to actually realizing that what we do in our own way, in our own little journey, actually has a big impact on other people. It can have a really big impact on other people. Even if we hardly say anything, if we just display patience or kindness or these little ways that we can actually be present for other people, that this path actually helps us find ways to do that and encourages us to do that. So it's 9:02. I guess we could end here. Does anyone have any other comments or questions?
I do actually.
Yes. No, please, go ahead.
So why is it referred to as a friend? Because friends are equal, and this is more like a guide.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's interesting because we talk about Maitri is friendliness to oneself. So I think it's the ground of friendliness. So this person comes in on your level, on your ground of friendliness, but they help bring you along further. and it's a spiritual friend. So they have more vision ahead on the path because they've been practicing longer than you have, or they've seen more or been with other teachers. So there's a way of providing more than just an example. Example is more the Hinayana, but in Mahayana, there's, you know, a friend can give you, well, I think it's just, it is, it's more than friend. Does it make any sense?
Or they're friends to us, we're not friends to them.
Right. It's, well, I think that's right. It
well,
means,
it's,
I
a
like
friend, it's a friend who doesn't necessarily going to buy the trip you're presenting.
Yeah, there's
right.
a great
that's the big
quote.
Difference.
Oh, there is.
There's a great quote
page
about...
Yes.
It's like, of course, your spiritual friend does not speak your domestic language, your petty language, but in a very strange combination, he, she is able to speak your language while at the same time not being wrapped up in the things that you usually get wrapped up in.
So it's kind of like a somebody that's really objective.
Yeah.
Right.
Objective friend.
Right. They don't let you off the hook. Okay, here, let me read this one paragraph. This is an... another chapter, the talk six. I just happened to see it today. And it's sort of a summary, I think, of these six talks. And then there is the spiritual friend. Finding a spiritual friend is a way of involving yourself further with the teachings. The spiritual friend acts as a mirror reflection. Your doubts and hesitations are thrown back to you, so you feel extremely threatened and confused. Your own private parts are exposed, mirrored back by the spiritual friend, which is further involvement with the teachings. So there's something very... the spiritual friend isn't just going to go along with your story, basically. Mm-hmm. There's a level of... I don't want to use the word confrontation, but...
Calling you out.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right, there you go. Spoken very well as a high school teacher. Calling you out on your BS. There you go. So there's the quality of shaking things up. So I think the approach is friendly, but, you know, there's something else going on in here. So.
But the friend is not a perfect human being.
No, it's, well, it's just another person.
A mirror can be cloudy. I mean, it's not like the...
So,
you know, it's just somebody.
That's okay. I mean, they're just trying to
just somebody
keep you on the path,
thought,
right?
Yeah.
Just kind of jog you along.
Somebody,
they're not leading
yeah.
you.
It's not
just
necessarily.
Saying, and I think that's a deliberate part of the choice is that not you know. He said, I think he said something about not using the word guru, so you don't get the
right.
idea that
yeah.
I just sit at his feet or her feet and then whoop, poof, I get all the enlightenment with no work.
No. You know, I've been a professional helper all my life. And I know this. I also been a helpee, and I went to a show. And there's a lot of pitfalls in being a helper. And the big one is standing over people or thinking you know more than they do. And I went to a thing on domestic violence once, where women had made T-shirts, and there was one that had a sing-songy thing on it. But a woman had written, "If you've come here to help me, go your way and let me be. If you've come here to share my sorrow, sit down and cry with me. If you've come here to share my joy, take my hand, we'll set each other free." I mean, it's very sing-songy, but I know there's like being a helper. There's a lot of...
This person isn't a helper.
In it.
The spiritual friend isn't really a helper. The spiritual friend will be very clear about the path. And it's up to the person whether or not they want to follow the path and whether or not they want to find their own truth. It's not really a helping relationship like that. And it's not one person over another either. It's just that someone, it's like, I don't think I would be a math teacher at Newton North because I'm not good at math, but I would be happy studying with Elise because she knows more than I do. That's really what it is. It's the spiritual friend actually has been working with the Buddha's teachings and can be a guide. That's what it is.
Okay.
So I think we should end here, and let's do our close. So if you're new, that sheet that you had, oh, it's back there, it's the Dedication of Merit.